Side 19, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 704. He had seen the bird in May of 1958, and they had all seen it in early August of 1958, and then, years later, while visiting his dying father, he had found out that Will Hanlon had seen it once too, after his escape from the fire at the Black Spot. The blood from Stan's tattered neck has dripped down and formed a coagulated pool on the fridge's bottom shelf. It glitters dark ruby red in the uncompromising glow shed by the fridge bulb. Mike manages, but no more sound than that can he make. Then the head opens its eyes, and they are the silver bright eyes of Pennywise the Clown. Those eyes roll in his direction, and the head's lips begin to squirm around the mouth full of feathers. It is trying to speak, perhaps trying to deliver prophecy like the oracle in a Greek play. Just thought I'd join you, Mike, because you can't win without me. You can't win without me, and you know it, don't you? You might have had a chance if all of me had shown up, but I just couldn't stand the strain on my all-American brain, if you see what I mean, Jellybean. All the six of you can do on your own is hash over some old times and then get yourselves killed. So I thought I'd head you off at the pass. Head you off, get it, Mikey? Get it, old pal? Get it, you fucking scumbag nigger? You're not real, he screams. But no sound comes out. He is like a TV with the volume control turned all the way down. Incredibly, grotesquely, the head winks at him. I'm real, all right. Real as raindrops. And you know what I'm talking about, Mikey. What the six of you are planning to try is like taking off in a jet plane with no landing gear. There's no sense in going up if you can't get back down, is there? No sense in going down if you can't get back up, either. You'll never think of the right riddles and jokes. You'll never make me laugh, Mikey. You've all forgotten how to turn your screens upside down. Beep, beep, Mikey, what do you say? Remember the bird? Nothing but a sparrow, but say, hey, it was a Lulu, wasn't it? Big as a barn, big as one of those silly Japanese movie monsters that used to scare you when you were a little kid. The days when you knew how to turn that bird from your door are gone forever. Believe it, Mikey. If you know how to use your head, you'll get out of here, out of Derry, right now. If you don't know how to use it, it'll end up just like this one here. Today's guidepost along the great road of life is, use it before you lose it, my good man. The head rolls over on its face. The feathers in its mouth make a horrid crumpling sound and falls out of the refrigerator. It sucks to the floor and rolls toward him like a hideous bowling ball, its blood-matted hair changing places with its grinning face. It rolls toward him, leaving a gluey trail of blood and dismembered bits of feather behind, its mouth working around its clot of feathers. Beep, beep, Mikey, it screams as Mike backs madly away from it, hands held out in a warding off gesture. Beep, 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 fucking beep. Then there is a sudden loud pop, the sound of a plastic cork thumbed out of a bottle of cheap champagne. The head disappears. Real? Mike thinks thickly. There was nothing supernatural about that pop, anyway. That was the sound of air rushing back into a suddenly vacated space. Real? Oh, God, real. A thin net of blood droplets floats up and then patters back down. No need to clean the lounge, though. Carol will see nothing when she comes in tomorrow. Not even if she has to plow her way through the balloons to get to the hot plate and make her first cup of coffee. How handy! He giggles shrilly. He looks up, and yes, the balloons are still there. The blue ones say, Derry niggers get the bird. The orange ones say, the losers are still losing. But Stanley Uris is finally ahead. No sense going up if you can't get back down, the speaking head had assured him. No sense going down if you can't get back up. This latter makes him think again of the stored miners' helmets. And was it true? Suddenly he's thinking about the first day he went down to the Barrens after the rock fight. July 6th, that had been, 2 days after he had marched in the 4th of July parade. 2 days after he had seen Pennywise the Clown in person for the first time. It had been after that day in the Barrens, after listening to their stories and then, hesitantly, telling his own that he had gone home and asked his father if he could look at his photograph album. Why exactly had he gone down to the Barrens that July 6th? Had he known he would find them there? It seemed that he had, and not just that they would be there, but where they would be. They had been talking about a clubhouse of some sort, he remembers. But it had seemed to him that they had been talking about that because there was something else that they didn't know how to talk about. Mike looks up at the balloons, not really seeing them now, trying to remember exactly how it had been that day, that hot, hot day. Suddenly it seems very important to remember just what had happened, what every nuance had been, what his state of mind had been. because that was when everything began to happen. Before that, the others had talked about killing it, but there had been no forward motion, no plan. When Mike had come, the circle closed. The wheel began to roll. It had been later that same day that Bill and Richie and Ben went down to the library and began to do serious research on an idea that Bill had had a day or a week or a month before. It had all begun to... Mike, Richie calls from the reference room where the others are gathered. Did you die in there? Almost, Mike thinks, looking at the balloons, the blood, the feathers inside the fridge. He calls back. I think you guys better come in here. He hears the scrape of their chairs, the mutter of their voices. He hears Richie saying, Oh, Jesus, what's up now? And another ear, this one in his memory, hears Richie saying something else. And suddenly he remembers what it is he has been searching for. Even more, he understands why it has seemed so elusive. The reaction of the others when he stepped into the clearing in the darkest, deepest, and most overgrown part of the barrens that day had been nothing. No surprise, no questions about how he had found them, no big deal. Ben had been eating a Twinkie, he remembers. Beverly and Richie had been smoking cigarettes. Bill had been lying on his back with his hands behind his head, looking at the sky. Eddie and Stan were looking doubtfully at a series of strings which had been pegged into the ground to form a square of about 5 feet on a side. No surprise, no questions, no big deal. He had simply shown up and been accepted. It was as if, without even knowing it, they had been waiting for him. And in that third ear, memory's ear, he hears Richie's pickaninny voice raised as it was earlier tonight. Lottie, Miss Claudie, here come... Two. That black child again. Locks a mussy. I don't know what this year barons is coming to. Look at that there nappy hay, Big Bill. Bill didn't even look around. He just went on staring dreamily at the fat summer clouds marching across the sky. He was giving an important question his most careful consideration. Richie was not offended by the lack of attention, however. He pushed onward. Just looking at that nappy hayed makes me believe I needs me another mint julep. I's gwineter have it out on the veranda, where it's be a little bit cooler. Beep, beep, Richie, Ben said from around a mouthful of Twinkie, and Beverly laughed. Hi, Mike said uncertainly. His heart was beating a little too hard, but he was determined to go on with this. He owed his thanks, and his father had told him that you always paid what you owed, and as quick as you could before the interest mounted up. Stan looked around. Hi, he said, and then looked back at the square of strings pegged into the center of the clearing. Ben, are you sure this is going to work? It'll work, Ben said. Hi, Mike. Want a cigarette? Beverly asked. I got two left. No, thank you. Mike took a deep breath and said, I wanted to thank you all again for helping me the other day. Those guys meant to hurt me bad. I'm sorry some of you guys got banged up. Bill waved his hand, dismissing it. Don't hurry about it. They've had it in for us all year. He sat up and looked at Mike with sudden starry interest. Can I ask you something? I guess so, Mike said. He sat down gingerly. He had heard such prefaces before. The Denbro kid was going to ask him what it was like to be a Negro. But instead, Bill said, When Larson pitched the no-hitter in the World Series 2 years ago, do you think that was just luck? Richie dragged deep on his cigarette and started to cough. Beverly pounded him good-naturedly on the back. You're just a beginner, Richie. You'll learn. I think it's gonna fall in, Ben, Eddie said worriedly, looking at the pegged square. I don't know how cool I am on the idea of getting buried alive. You're not going to get buried alive, Ben said. And if you are, just suck your damn old aspirator until someone pulls you out. This struck Stanley Uris as deliciously funny. He leaned back on his elbow, his head turned up to the sky, and laughed until Eddie kicked his shin and told him to shut up. Luck, Mike said finally. I think any no-hitter is more luck than skill. Me too, Bill said. Mike waited to see if there was more, but Bill seemed satisfied. He lay down again, laced his hands behind his head again, and went back to studying the clouds as they floated by. What are you guys up to? Mike asked, looking at the square of strings pegged just above the ground. Oh, this is Haystack's big idea of the week, Richie said. Last time he flooded out the barrens, and that was pretty good, but this one's a real dinner winner. This is Dig Your Own Clubhouse Month. Next month... You don't need to put Ben down, Bill said, looking at the sky. It's going to be good. God's sake, Bill, I was just kidding. So sometimes you kid too much, Richie. Richie accepted the rebuke silently. I still don't get it, Mike said. Well, it's pretty simple, Ben said. They wanted a treehouse, and we could do that, but people have a bad habit of breaking their bones when they fall out of treehouses. Kooky, lend me your bones, Stan said, and laughed again while the others looked at him, puzzled. Stan did not have much sense of humor, and the bit he did have was sort of peculiar. You is gone loco, senor, Richie said. It's the heat and the cucarachas, I think. Anyway, Ben said, what we'll do is dig down about 5 feet in the square I pegged out there. We can't go much deeper than that or we'll hit groundwater, I guess. It's pretty close to the surface down here. Then we'll shore up the sides just to make sure they don't cave in. He looked significantly at Eddie here, but Eddie was worried. Then what? Mike asked, interested. We'll cap off the top. Huh? Put boards over the top of the hole. We can put in a trap door or something so we can get in and out. Even windows if we want. We'll need some hinges, Bill said, still looking at the clouds. We can get those at Reynolds Hardware, Ben said. You guys have your allowances, Bill said. I've got $5, Beverly said. I saved it up from babysitting. Richie immediately began to crawl toward her on his hands and knees. I love you, Bevy, he said, making dog's eyes at her. Will you marry me? We'll live in a pine-studded bungalow. A what? Beverly asked, while Ben watched them with an odd mixture of anxiety, amusement, and concentration. A bung-studded pine-a-low, Richie said. $5 is enough, sweetie, you and me, and baby makes three. Beverly laughed and blushed and moved away from him. We should share the expenses, Bill said. That's why we got a club. So after we capped the hole with boards, Ben went on, we put down this heavy-duty glue, tangle track, they call it, and put the sods back on. Maybe sprinkle it with pine needles. We could be down there and people like Henry Bowers, could walk right over us and not even know we were there. You thought of that? Mike said. Geez, that's great. Ben smiled. It was his turn to blush. Bill sat up suddenly and looked at Mike. You will want to help? Well, sure, Mike said. That'd be fun. A look passed among the others. Mike felt it as well as saw it. There are 7 of us here, Mike thought, and for no reason at all he shivered. When are you going to break ground? Pretty soon, Bill said, and Mike knew, that it wasn't just Ben's underground clubhouse Bill was talking about. Ben knew it too, so did Richie, Beverly, and Eddie. Stan Uris had stopped smiling. Well, we're going to start this project pretty soon. There was a pause then, and Mike was suddenly aware of 2 things. They wanted to say something, tell him something, and he was not entirely sure he wanted to hear it. Ben had picked up a stick and was doodling aimlessly in the dirt, his hair hiding his face. Richie was gnawing at his already ragged fingernails. Only Bill was looking directly at Mike. Is something wrong? Mike asked uneasily. Speaking very slowly, Bill said, Well, we're a club. You can be in the club if you want. But you have to keep our secrets. You mean like the clubhouse? Mike asked, now more uneasy than ever. Well, sure. We've got another secret, kid, Richie said, still not looking at Mike. And Big Bill says we've got something more important to do this summer than digging underground clubhouses. He's right, too, Ben added. There was a sudden whistling gasp. Mike jumped. It was only Eddie blasting off. Eddie looked at Mike apologetically, shrugged, and then nodded. Well, Mike said finally, don't keep me in suspense. Tell me. Bill was looking at the others. Is there anyone who doesn't want him in the club? No one spoke or raised a hand. Who wants to tell? Bill asked. There was another long pause, and this time Bill didn't break it. At last Beverly sighed and looked up at Mike. The kids who have been killed, she said. We know who's been doing it. And it's not human. 3. They told him one by one. The clown on the ice, the leper under the porch, the blood and voices from the drain, the dead boys in the standpipe. Richie told about what had happened when he and Bill went back to Nebold Street, and Bill spoke last, telling about the school photo that had moved, and the picture he had stuck his hand into. He finished by explaining that it had killed his brother Georgie and that the Losers Club was dedicated to killing the monster, whatever the monster really was. Mike thought later, going home that night, that he should have listened with disbelief mounting into horror and finally run away as fast as he could, not looking back, convinced either that he was being put on by a bunch of white kids who didn't like black folks, or that he was in the presence of six authentic lunatics who had in some way caught their lunacy from each other, the way everyone in the same class could catch a particularly virulent cold. But he didn't run, because in spite of the horror, he felt a strange sense of comfort. Comfort and something else. Something more elemental. A feeling of coming home. "There are seven of us here," he thought again as Bill finally finished speaking. He opened his mouth, not sure of what he was going to say. "I've seen the clown," he said. "What?" Richie and Stan asked together, and Beverly turned her head so quickly that her ponytail flipped from her left shoulder to her right. "I saw him on the 4th," Mike said slowly, speaking to Bill mostly. Bill's eyes, sharp and utterly concentrated, were on his, demanding that he go on. "Yes, on the 4th of July." He trailed off momentarily, thinking. "But I knew him. I knew him because that wasn't the first time I saw him. And it wasn't the first time I saw something wrong." He thought of the bird then, the first time he'd really allowed himself to think of it, except in nightmares, since May. He had thought he was going crazy. It was a relief to find out he wasn't crazy, but it was still a scary relief. He wet his lips. "Go on," Bev said impatiently. "Hurry up." "Well, the thing is, I was in the parade. I saw you," Eddie said. "You were playing the saxophone." "Well, it's actually a trombone," Mike said. "I play with the Niebold Church School Band. Anyway, I saw the clown. He was handing out balloons to kids on the three-way corner downtown. He was just like Ben and Bill said. Silver suit, orange buttons, white makeup on his face, big red smile. I don't know if it was lipstick or makeup, but it looked like blood." The others were nodding, excited now, but Bill only went on looking at Mike closely.
Orange tuft of her hair?"
he asked Mike, making them unconsciously over his own head with his fingers. Mike nodded.
"Seeing him like that, it scared me. And while I was looking at him, he turned around and waved at me, like he'd read my mind, or my feelings, or whatever you call it. And that, like, scared me worse. I didn't know why then, but he scared me so bad for a couple of seconds I couldn't play my bone anymore. All the spit in my mouth dried up, and I felt..." He glanced briefly at Beverly. He remembered it all so clearly now. How the sun had suddenly seemed intolerably dazzling on the brass of his horn, and the chrome of the cars, the music too loud, the sky too blue. The clown had raised one white-gloved hand. The other was full of balloon strings, and it waved slowly back and forth, his bloody grin too red and too wide, a scream turned upside down. He remembered how the flesh of his testicles had begun to crawl, how his bowels had suddenly felt all loose and hot, as if he might suddenly drop a casual load of shit into his pants. But he couldn't say any of that in front of Beverly. You didn't say stuff like that in front of girls. Even if they were the sort of girls you could say things like bitch and bastard in front of. "I felt scared," he finished, feeling that was too weak, but not knowing how to say the rest. But they were nodding as if they understood, and he felt an indescribable relief wash through him. Somehow that clown looking at him, smiling his red smile, his white-gloved hand penduluming slowly back and forth, that had been worse than having Henry Bowers and the rest after him. Ever so much worse. "Then we were past," Mike went on. "We marched up Main Street Hill. And I saw him again, handing out balloons to kids. Except a lot of them didn't want to take them. Some of the little ones were crying. I couldn't figure out how he could have gotten up there so fast. I thought to myself that there must be two of them, you know, both of them dressed the same way, a team. But then he turned around and waved to me again, and I knew it was him. It was the same man." "He's not a man," Richie said, and Beverly shuddered. Bill put his arm around her for a moment, and she looked at him gratefully. "He waved to me, and then he winked, like we had a secret, or like maybe he knew I'd recognized him." Bill dropped his arm from Beverly's shoulders. "You recognized him?" "I think so," Mike said. "I have to check something before I say it's for sure. My father's got some pictures. He collects them. Listen, you guys play down here a lot, don't you?" "Sure," Ben said. That's why we're building a clubhouse. Mike nodded. I'll check and see if I'm right. If I am, I can bring the pictures.
Old pictures?
Bill asked.
Yes.
Well, what else? Bill asked. Mike opened his mouth and then closed it again. He looked around at them uncertainly and then said,
You'd think I was crazy. Crazy or lying.
Did you think we're crazy?
Mike shook his head.
You bet we're not, Eddie said. I got a lot wrong with me, but I'm not Bughouse. I don't think.
No, Mike said, I don't think you're crazy.
Well, we'd won't think you're nuts
either, Bill said.
Mike looked them all over, cleared his throat, and said,
I saw a bird. Three months ago. I saw a bird.
Stan Urus looked at Mike.
What kind of bird?
Speaking more reluctantly than ever, Mike said,
It looked like a sparrow, sort of, but it also looked like a robin. It had an orange chest.
Well, what's so special about a bird? Ben asked. There are lots of birds in Derry.
But he felt uneasy, and looking at Stan, he felt sure that Stan was remembering what had happened in the standpipe, and how he had somehow stopped it from happening by shouting out the names of birds. But he forgot all about that and everything else when Mike spoke again.
This bird was bigger than a house trailer, he said.
He looked at their shocked, amazed faces. He waited for their laughter, but none came. Stan looked as if someone had clipped him with a brick. His face had gone so pale it was the color of muted November sunlight.
I swear it's true, Mike said. It was a giant bird, like one of those birds in the monster movies that are supposed to be prehistoric.
Yeah, like in The Giant Claw, Richie said. He thought the bird in that had been sort of fake-looking, but by the time it got to New York, he had still been excited enough to spill his popcorn over the balcony railing at the Aladdin. Foxy Foxworth would have kicked him out, but the movie was over by then anyway. Sometimes you got the shit kicked out of you, but as Big Bill said, sometimes you won one too.
But it didn't look prehistoric, Mike said, and it didn't look like one of those, what do you call them, the Greeks and Romans made up stories about.
Rocks? Bill suggested.
Right, I guess so. It wasn't like those either. It was just like a combination robin and sparrow, the two most common birds you see.
He laughed a little wildly.
Wibble where? Bill began.
Tell us, Beverly said simply. And after a moment to collect his thoughts, Mike did. And telling it, watching their faces grow concerned and scared, but not disbelieving or derisive, he felt an incredible weight lift from his chest. Like Ben with his mummy, or Eddie with his leper, and Stan with the drowned boys, he had seen a thing that would have driven an adult insane, not just with terror, but with the walloping force of an unreality too great to be explained away or, lacking any rational explanation, simply ignored. Elijah's face had been burned black by the light of God's love, or so Mike had read. But Elijah had been an old man when it happened, and maybe that made a difference. Hadn't one of those other Bible fellows, this one little more than a kid, actually wrestled an angel to a draw? He had seen it, and he had gone on with his life. He had integrated the memory into his view of the world. He was still young enough, so that view was tremendously wide. But what had happened that day had nonetheless haunted his mind's darker corners, and sometimes in his dreams he ran from that grotesque bird as it printed its shadow on him from above. Some of these dreams he remembered and some he did not. But they were there, shadows which moved by themselves. How little of it he had forgotten and how greatly it had troubled him as he went about his daily round, helping his father, going to school, riding his bike, doing errands for his mother, waiting for the black groups to come on American Bandstand after school, was perhaps measurable in only one way. The relief he felt in sharing it with the others. As he did, he realized it was the first time he had even allowed himself to think of it fully since that early morning by the canal, when he had seen those odd grooves and the blood. 4. Mike told the story of the bird at the old ironworks and how he had run into the pipe to escape it. Later on that afternoon, three of the losers, Ben, Richie, Bill, walked toward the Derry Public Library. Ben and Richie were keeping a close watch for Bowers and company, but Bill only looked at the sidewalk, frowning, lost in thought. About an hour after telling them his story, Mike had left them, saying his father wanted him home by 4 to pick peas. Beverly had to do some marketing and fix dinner for her father, she said. Both Eddie and Stan had their own things to do.
But before they broke up for the day, they began digging what was to become, if Ben was right, their underground clubhouse. To Bill, and to all of them, he suspected, the groundbreaking had seemed an almost symbolic act. They had begun. Whatever it was they were supposed to do as a group, as a unit, they had begun. Ben asked Bill if he believed Mike Hanlon's story. They were passing Derry Community House, and the library was just ahead, a stone oblong comfortably shaded by elms a century old and as yet untouched by the Dutch elm disease that would later plague and thin them.
Yeah, Bill said. I think it was the Trahuth. Kick-a-crazy, but true. What about you, Ribber Richie?
Richie nodded. Yeah. I hate to believe it, if you know what I mean, but I guess I do.
You remember what he said about the bird's tongue?
Bill and Ben nodded. Orange fluffs on it.
That's the kicker, Richie said. It's like some comic book villain, Lex Luthor or the Joker or someone like that. It always leaves a trademark.
Bill nodded thoughtfully. It was like some comic book villain.
Because they saw it that way? Thought of it that way?
Yes, perhaps so.
It was kid stuff, but it seemed that was what this thing thrived on. Kid stuff.
They crossed the street to the library side.
I asked Stan if he ever heard of a bird like that, Bill said.
Not necessarily a big one, but just a real one, Richie suggested.
Bill nodded. He said there might be a bird like that in South America or Africa, but not around here.
He didn't believe it then? Ben asked.
He believed it, Bill said.
And then he told them something else Stan had suggested when Bill walked with him back to where Stan had left his bike. Stan's idea was that nobody else could have seen that bird before Mike told them that story. Something else, maybe, but not that bird, because the bird was Mike Hanlon's personal monster. But now, why now that bird was the property of the whole Losers Club, wasn't it? Any of them might see it. It might not look exactly the same. Bill might see it as a crow, Richie as a hawk, Beverly as a golden eagle, for all Stan knew. But it could be a bird to all of them now. Bill told Stan that if that was true, then any of them might see the leper, the mummy, or possibly the dead boys.
Which means we ought to do something pretty soon if we're going to do anything at all, Stan had replied. It knows.
What? Bill had asked sharply.
Everything we know?
Man, if it knows that, we're sunk, Stan had answered.
But you can bet it knows we know about it. I think it'll try to get us.
Are you still thinking about what we talked about yesterday?
Yes.
I wish I could go with you.
Ben and Richie will be well. Ben's really sister smart, and Richie is too when he isn't fucking off.
Now standing outside the library, Richie asked Bill exactly what it was he had in mind. Bill told them, speaking slowly so he wouldn't stutter too badly. The idea had been circling in his mind for the last 2 weeks, but it had taken Mike's story of the bird to crystallize it.
What did you do if you wanted to get rid of a bird?
Well, shooting it was pretty goddamn final.
What did you do if you wanted to get rid of a monster?
Well, the movie suggested that shooting it with a silver bullet was pretty goddamn final. Ben and Richie listened to this respectfully enough. Then Richie asked, How do you get a silver bullet, Big Bill? Send away for it?
Very funny. We'll have to make it.
How?
I guess that's what we're at the library to find out, Ben said.
Richie nodded and pushed his glasses up on his nose. Behind them, his eyes were sharp and thoughtful, but doubtful, Bill thought. He felt doubtful himself. At least there was no foolishness in Richie's eyes, and that was a step in the right direction.
You thinking about your dad's Walther? Richie asked. The one we took to Nebold Street?
Yes, Bill said.
Even if we could really make silver bullets, Richie said, where would we get the silver?
Let me worry about that, Ben said quietly. Well, okay, Richie said. We'll let Haystack worry about that.
Then what? Nebold Street again?
Bill nodded.
Nebold Street again.
And then we blow its fucking head off. The three of them stood there a moment longer, looking at each other solemnly, and then they went into the library. 5.
Sure and begorra, it's that black feller again, Richie cried in his Irish cop voice.
A week had passed, it was nearly mid-July, and the underground clubhouse was almost finished. "Top of the morning to ye, Mr. O'Hanlon, sir, and a fine, fine day it promises to be. Fine as percaters a-growin', as me old mither used to."
"So far as I know, noon is the top of the morning, Richie," Ben said, popping up in the hole, "and noon was 2 hours ago."
He and Richie had been putting in shoring around the sides of the hole. Ben had taken off his sweatshirt because the day was hot and the work was hard. His T-shirt was gray with sweat and stuck to his chest and pouch of a stomach. He seemed remarkably unself-conscious of the way he looked, but Mike guessed that if Ben heard Beverly coming, he would be inside that baggy sweatshirt again before you could say puppy love.
"Don't be so picky. You sound like Stan the Man," Richie said.
He had gotten out of the hole 5 minutes before because, he told Ben, it was time for a cigarette break.
"I thought you said you didn't have any cigarettes," Ben had said.
"I don't," Richie had replied, "but the principle remains the same." Mike had his father's photograph album under his arm.
"Where is everybody?" he asked.
He knew Bill had to be somewhere around because he had left his own bike parked under the bridge near Silver.
"Bill and Eddie went down to the dump about half an hour ago to liberate some more boards," Richie said. "Stanny and Bev went down to Reynolds Hardware to get hinges. I don't know what the frock haystack's up to down there."
"Up to down there, ha ha, you get it? But it's probably no good. Boy needs someone to keep an eye on him, you know. By the way, you owe us 23 cents if you still want to be in this club. Your share of the hinges."
Mike switched the album from his right arm to his left and dug into his pocket. He counted out 23 cents, leaving a grand total of 1 dime in his own personal treasury, and handed it over to Richie. Then he walked over to the hole and looked in. Except it really wasn't a hole anymore. The sides had been neatly squared off. Each side had been shored up. The boards were all mongrels, but Ben, Bill, and Stan had done a good job of sizing them with tools from Zach Denbro's shop, and Bill had been at great pains to make sure every tool was returned every night and in the same condition as when it was taken. Ben and Beverly had nailed cross pieces between the supports. The hole still made Eddie a little nervous, but that was Eddie's nature. Piled carefully to one side were squares of sod which would later be glued to the top.
"I think you guys know what you're doing," Mike said.
"Sure," Ben said, and pointed to the album.
"What you got?"
"My father's dairy album," Mike said. "He collects old pictures and clippings about the town. It's his hobby. I was looking through it a couple of days ago. I told you I thought I'd seen that clown before, and I did, in here. So I brought it down."
He was too ashamed to add that he had not dared to ask his father's permission to do this. Afraid of the questions to which such a request might lead, he had taken it from the house like a thief while his father planted potatoes in the west field and his mother hung clothes in the backyard.
"I thought you guys ought to take a look, too."
"Well, let's see," Richie said.
"I'd like to wait until everybody's here. It might be better."
"Okay." Richie was, in truth, not that anxious to look at more pictures of Derry in this or any other album. Not after what had happened in Georgie's room.
"You want to help me and Ben with the rest of the shoring?"
"You bet." Mike put his father's album down carefully, far enough from the hole so it wouldn't be pelted with flying dirt, and took Ben's shovel.
"Dig right here," Ben said, showing Mike the spot. "Go down about a foot, then I'll set a board in and hold it flush against the side while you shovel the dirt back in."
"Good plan, man," Richie said sagely from where he sat on the edge of the excavation with his sneakers dangling down.
"What's wrong with you?" Mike asked.
"Got a bone in my leg," Richie said comfortably.
"How's your project with Bill going?"
Mike stopped long enough to strip off his shirt and then began to dig. It was hot down here, even in the barrens. Crickets hummed sleepily like summer clocks in the brush.
"Well, not too bad," Richie said, and Mike thought he flashed Ben a mildly warning look.
"I guess."
"Why don't you play your radio, Richie?" Ben asked.
He slipped a board into the hole Mike had dug and held it there. Richie's transistor was hung by the strap in its accustomed place on the thick branch of a nearby shrub.
"Batteries are worn out," Richie said. "You had to have my last 25 cents for hinges, remember? Cruel, Haystack, very cruel.
After all the things I've done for you. Besides, all I can get down here is WABI and they only play pansy rock."
"Huh?" Mike asked.
"Haystack thinks Tommy Sands and Pat Boone sing rock and roll," Richie said. "But that's because he's ill. Elvis sings rock and roll. Ernie K. Doe sings rock and roll. Carl Perkins sings rock and roll. Bobby Darin, Buddy Holly.
Oh, Peggy, my Peggy Sue, uh-oh."
"Pleased, Richie," Ben said.
Also, Mike said, leaning on his shovel, there's Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Shep and the Limelights, Laverne Baker, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, the Coasters, the Isley Brothers, the Crests, the Chords, Stick McGee. They were looking at him with such amazement that Mike laughed. You lost me after Little Richard, Richie said. He liked Little Richard, but if he had a secret rock and roll hero that summer, it was Jerry Lee Lewis. His mom had happened to come into the living room while Jerry Lee was performing on American Bandstand. This was at the point in his act where Jerry Lee actually climbed onto his piano and played it upside down with his hair hanging in his face. He had been singing High School Confidential. For a moment, Richie believed his mom was going to faint. She didn't, but she was so traumatized by what she had seen that she talked at dinner that night about sending Richie to one of those military-type camps for the rest of the summer. Now Richie shook his hair down over his eyes and began to sing. Come on over, baby, all the cats are at the high school rockin'. Ben began to stagger around the hole, grasping his large belly and pretending to puke. Mike held his nose, but he was laughing so hard tears squirted out of his eyes. What's wrong? Richie demanded. I mean, what ails you guys? That was good. I mean, that was really good. Oh, man, Mike said. And now he was laughing so hard he could barely talk. That was priceless. I mean, that was really priceless. Negroes have no taste, Richie said. I think it even says so in the Bible. Yo mama, Mike said, laughing harder than ever. When Richie asked with honest bewilderment what that meant, Mike sat down with a thump and rocked back and forth, howling and holding his stomach. You probably think I'm jealous, Richie said. You probably think I want to be a Negro. Now Ben also fell down, laughing wildly. His whole body rippled and quaked alarmingly. His eyes bulged. No more, Richie, he managed. I'm going to shit my pants. I'm going to die if you don't stop. I don't want to be a Negro, Richie said. Who wants to wear pink pants and live in Boston and buy pizza by the slice? I want to be Jewish like Stan. I want to own a pawn shop and sell people switchblades and plastic dog puke and used guitars. Ben and Mike were now actually screaming with laughter. Their laughter echoed through the green and jungly ravine that was the misnamed Barrens, causing birds to take wing and squirrels to freeze momentarily on limbs. It was a young sound, penetrating, lively, vital, unsophisticated, free. Almost every living thing within range of that sound reacted to it in some way. But the thing which had tumbled out of a wide concrete drain and into the upper Kanduskeag was not living. The previous afternoon there had been a sudden driving thunderstorm. The clubhouse to be had not been much affected. Since digging operations had begun, Ben had covered the hole carefully each evening with the ragged piece of tarpaulin Eddie had scrounged from behind Wally's spa. It smelled painty, but it did the job. And the storm drains under Derry had run with violent water for 2 or 3 hours. It was that spate of water that had pushed this unpleasant baggage into the sun for the flies to find. It was the body of a 9-year-old named Jimmy Cullum. Except for the nose, his face was gone. There was a churned and featureless mess where it had been. This raw meat was dotted with deep black marks that perhaps only Stan Uris would have recognized for what they were. Pecks. Pecks made by a very large beak. Water rilled over Jimmy Cullum's muddy chino pants. His white hands floated like dead fish. They had also been pecked, although not as badly. His paisley shirt ballooned out and collapsed back, ballooned out and collapsed back like a bladder. Bill and Eddie, loaded down with boards scrounged from the dump, crossed the Kanduskeag by stepping stones less than 40 yards from the body. They heard Richie, Ben, and Mike laughing, smiled a little themselves, and hurried past the unseen ruin of Jimmy Cullum to see what was so funny. 6. They were still laughing as Bill and Eddie came into the clearing, sweating under their load of lumber. Even Eddie, usually as pale as cheese, had some color in his face. They dropped the new boards on the almost depleted supply pile. Ben climbed out of the hole to inspect them. Good deal, he said. Wow, great. Bill collapsed to the ground. Can I have my heart attack now, or do I have to wait until later? Have it later, Ben said absently. He had brought a few tools of his own down to the Barrens, and was now going over the new boards carefully, pounding out nails and removing screws. He tossed one aside because it was splintered. Rapping on another returned a dull, punky sound in at least 3 places, and he also tossed that one aside. Eddie sat on a pile of dirt, watching him. He took a honk on his aspirator as Ben pulled a rusty nail from a board with the claw end of his hammer. The nail squealed like some small, unpleasant animal that had been stepped on and didn't like it. You can get tetanus if you cut yourself on a rusty nail, Eddie informed Ben.
Yeah?
Richie said. What's tetanus? Sounds like a woman's disease.
You're a bird, Eddie said. It's tetanus, not titanus, and it means lockjaw.
There's these special microbes that grow in rust, see, and if you cut yourself, they can get inside your body and, fuck up your nerves.
Eddie went an even darker red and took another fast honk on his aspirator.
Lockjaw, Jesus, Richie said, impressed. That sounds mean.
You bet. First, your jaw locks up so tight you can't open your mouth, not even to eat.
They have to cut a hole in your cheek and feed you liquids through a tube.
Oh, man, Mike said, standing up in the hole. His eyes were wide, the corneas very white in his brown face.
For sure?
My mom told me, Eddie said. Then your throat locks up and you can't eat anymore and you starve to death.
They contemplated this horror in silence.
There's no cure, Eddie amplified.
More silence.
So, Eddie said briskly, I always watch out for rusty nails and shit like that. I had to have a tetanus shot once, and it really hurt.
So why'd you go to the dump with Bill and bring all this crap back? Richie asked.
Eddie glanced briefly at Bill, who was looking into the clubhouse, and there was all the love and hero worship in that gaze needed to answer such a question, but Eddie said softly,
Some stuff has to be done even if there is a risk. That's the first important thing I ever found out I didn't find out from my mother.
A further silence, not quite uncomfortable, followed. Then Ben went back to pounding out rusty nails, and after a while, Mike Hanlon joined him. Richie's transistor, robbed of its voice, at least until Richie's allowance came in or he found a lawn to mow, swung from its low branch in a mild breeze. Bill had time to reflect upon how odd all this was, how odd and how perfect that they should all be here this summer. There were kids he knew visiting relatives, kids he knew who were off on vacations at Disneyland in California, or on Cape Cod, or, in the case of one chum, an unimaginably distant-sounding place with the queer but somehow evocative name of Kestat. There were kids at church camp, kids at scout camp, kids at rich kid camps where you could learn to swim and play golf, camps where you learned to say, hey, good one, instead of fuck you, when your opponent got a killer serve past you at tennis. Kids whose parents had simply taken them away. Bill could understand that. He knew some kids who wanted to go away, frightened by the boogeyman stalking Derry this summer, but suspected there were more parents frightened by that boogeyman. People who had planned to take their vacations at home suddenly decided to go away. Kestat. Was that in Sweden? Argentina? Spain?
Instead.
It was a little like the polio scare of 1956, when four kids who went swimming in the O'Brien Memorial Pool had gotten the disease. Grown-ups, a word absolutely synonymous in Bill's mind with mothers and fathers, had decided then, as now, that away was better, safer. Anyone able to clear out had cleared. Bill understood away, and he could muse over a word of such fabulous wonder as Kestat. But wonder was cold comfort compared with desire. Kestat was away. Derry was desire.
And none of us have gone away, he thought.
Watching as Ben and Mike pounded used nails out of used boards, as Eddie strolled off into the bushes to take a whiz, you had to go as soon as you could in order to avoid seriously straining your bladder, he told Bill once, but you also had to watch out for poison ivy, because who needed a case of that on your pecker?
We're all here in Derry. No camp, no relatives, no vacations, no away. All right here, present and accounted for.
There's a door down there, Eddie said, zipping his fly as he came back.
Hope you shook off, Eds, Richie said. If you don't shake off each time, you can get cancer. My mom told me so.
Eddie looked startled, thinly worried, and then saw Richie's grin. He withered him, or tried to, with a baby's must-play look, and then said,
It was too big for us to carry, but Bill said if all of us went down, we could get it up here.
Of course, you can never shake off completely, Richie went on. You want to know what a wise man once told me, Eds?
No, Eddie said, and I don't want you to call me Eds anymore, Richie. I mean, I'm sincere. I don't call you Dick, as in, you got any gum on your dick? So I don't see why...
This wise man, Richie said, told me this. No matter how much you squirm and dance, the last two drops go in your pants.
And that's why there's so much cancer in the world, Eddie, my love.
The reason there's so much cancer in the world is because nerds like you and Beverly Marsh smoke cigarettes, Eddie said.
Beverly is not a nerd, Ben said in a forbidding voice. You just watch what you say, trash mouth.
Beep, beep, you guys, Bill said absently. And speaking of Beverly, she's pretty strong. She could help get that to door.
Ben asked what kind of door it was.
Mahogany, I think.
Somebody threw out a mahogany door? Ben asked, surprised but not unbelieving.
People throw out everything, Mike said. That dump, it kills me to go down there. I mean, it kills me.
Yeah, Ben agreed. A lot of that stuff could be fixed up easy. And there are people in China and South America with nothing. That's what my mother says.
There's people with nothing right here in Maine, Sonny Jim, Richie said grimly.
Well, what's the this? Bill asked, noticing the album Mike had brought. Mike told him, saying he would show them the picture of the clown when Stan and Beverly got back with the hinges.
Bill and Richie exchanged a look.
What's wrong? Mike asked.
Is it what happened in your brother's room, Bill?
Yeah, Bill said, and would say no more.
They took turns working on the hole until Stan and Beverly came back, each with a brown paper bag containing hinges. As Mike talked, Ben sat cross-legged, tailor fashion, and made glassless windows that would swing open and shut in two of the long boards. Perhaps only Bill noticed how quickly and easily his fingers moved, how adept and knowing they were, like surgeon's fingers. Bill admired that.
Some of these pictures go back 100 years, my dad said, Mike told them, holding the album on his lap.
He gets them at those sales people have in their yards and at second-hand shops. Sometimes he buys them or trades other collectors for them. Some of them are stereoscopes. There's two of them just the same on a long card, and when you look at them through this thing like binoculars, it looks like one picture, only in 3D, like House of Wax or The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Why does he like all that stuff? Beverly asked.
She was wearing ordinary Levi's, but she had done something amusing to the cuffs, blousing them out with a bright paisley material for the final 4 inches so that they looked like pants out of some sailor's whimsy.
Yeah, Eddie said. Most of the time, Derry's pretty boring.
Well, I don't know for sure, but I think it's because he wasn't born here, Mike said diffidently.
It's like, I don't know, like it's all new to him. Or like, you know, if you came in during the middle of a movie.
Sure. You'd want to see this start, Bill said.
Yeah, Mike said. There's a lot of history lying around in Derry. I kind of like it. And I think some of it has to do with this thing, this it, if you want to call it that.
He looked at Bill, and Bill nodded, his eyes thoughtful.
So I was looking through it after the 4th of July parade because I knew I'd seen that clown before. I knew it.
And look. He opened the book, thumbed through it, then handed it to Ben, who was sitting on his right.
Don't touch the pages, Bill said.
And there was such urgency in his voice that they all jumped. He had fisted the hand he had cut reaching into Georgie's album, Richie saw. Fisted it into a tight, protective knot.
Bill's right, Richie said. And that subdued, totally un-Richie-like voice was a powerful convincer.
Be careful. It's like Stan said. If we saw it happen, you guys could see it happen, too.
Feel it, Bill added grimly.
The album went from hand to hand, each of them holding the book gingerly by the edges, as if it were old dynamite sweating big beads of nitro.
It came back to Mike. He opened it to one of the first pages.
Daddy says there's no way to date that one, but it's probably from the early or mid-1700s, Mike said. He repaired a guy's bandsaw for a box of old books and pictures. That was one of them. He says it might be worth $40 or even more.
The picture was a woodcut, the size of a large postcard. When Bill's turn came to look at it, he was relieved to see that Mike's father had the kind of album where the pictures were under a protective plastic sheet.
He looked fascinated, and he thought, there. I am seeing him, or it. Really seeing. That's the face of the enemy.
The picture showed a funny fellow juggling oversized bowling pins in the middle of a muddy street. There were a few houses on either side of the street, and a few huts that Bill guessed were stores or trading posts, or whatever they called them back then. It didn't look like Derry at all, except for the canal. It was there, neatly cobbled on both sides. In the upper background, Bill could see a team of mules on a towpath dragging a barge. There was a group of maybe half a dozen kids gathered around the funny fellow. One of them was wearing a pastoral straw hat. Another had a hoop and a stick to roll it with. Not the sort of stick that would come with the hoop that you bought today in a Woolworth's. It was a branch from a tree. Bill could see the bare knobs on it where smaller branches had been lopped off with a knife or a hatchet. That baby wasn't made in Taiwan or Korea, he thought, fascinated by this boy who could have been him if he'd been born four or five generations before. The funny fellow had a huge grin on his face. He wore no makeup, except to Bill his whole face looked like makeup. But he was bald except for two tufts of hair that stuck up like horns over his ears, and Bill had no trouble recognizing their clown. 200 years ago or more, he thought, and felt a crazy surge of terror, anger, and excitement rush through him. 27 years later, sitting in the Derry Public Library and remembering his first look into Mike's father's album, he realized he had felt the way a hunter might feel, coming upon the first fresh spoor of an old killer tiger. 200 years ago. That long, and only God knows how much longer. This led him to wonder just how long the spirit of Pennywise had been here in Derry. But he found that was a thought he did not really want to pursue. "Gimme, Bill," Richie was saying, but Bill held the album a moment longer, staring fixedly at the woodcut, sure it would begin to move. The bowling pins, if that's what they were, which the funny fellow was juggling, would rise and fall, rise and fall. The kids would laugh and applaud, except maybe they wouldn't all laugh and applaud. Some of them might scream and run instead. The mule team pulling the barge would move beyond the borders of the picture. It didn't happen, and he passed the book on to Richie. When the album came back to Mike, he turned some more pages, hunting. "Here," he said. "This one is from 1856, 4 years before Lincoln was elected president." The book went around again. This was a color picture, a sort of cartoon, which showed a bunch of drunks standing in front of a saloon while a fat politician with mutton chop whiskers declaimed from a board that had been set between two hogsheads. He held a foamy pitcher of beer in one hand. The board upon which he stood was considerably bowed with his weight. Some distance off, a group of bonneted women were looking at this show of mingled buffoonery and intemperance with disgust. The caption below the picture read, "Politics in Derry is thirsty work, says Senator Garner." "Daddy says pictures like this were really popular for about 20 years before the Civil War," Mike said. "They called them fool cards, and people used to send them to each other. They were like some of the jokes in Mad, I guess." "Satire," Bill said. "Yeah," Mike said. "But now look down in the corner of this one." The picture was like Mad in another way. It had as many details and little side jokes as a big Mort Drucker panel in a Mad Magazine movie takeoff. There was a grinning fat man pouring a glass of beer down a spotted dog's throat. There was a woman who had fallen on her prat in a mud puddle. There were two street urchins slyly sticking sulfur-headed matches into the soles of a prosperous-looking businessman's shoes, and a girl swinging from her heels in an elm tree so that her underpants showed. But despite this bewildering intaglio of detail, none of them really needed Mike to point the clown out. Dressed in a loud-checked, vest-busting drummer's suit, he was playing the shell game with a bunch of drunken loggers. He was winking at a lumberjack who had, to judge by the gape-mouthed look of surprise on his face, just picked the wrong nutshell. The drummer clown was taking a coin from him. "Him again," Ben said. "What, 100 years later?" "Just about," Mike said. "And here's one from 1891. It was a clipping from the front page of the Derry News. "Huzzah," the headline proclaimed exuberantly. "Ironworks opens." Just below this, "Town turns out for gala picnic." The picture showed a woodcut of the ribbon-cutting ceremony at the Kitchener Ironworks. Its style reminded Bill of the Currier and Ives prints his mother had in the dining room, although this was nowhere near as polished. A fellow tricked out in a morning coat and top hat was holding a large pair of open-jawed scissors above the ironworks ribbon, while a crowd of perhaps 500 watched. Off to the left was a clown, their clown, turning a handspring for a group of children. The artist had caught him upside down, turning his smile into a scream. He passed the book on quickly to Richie. The next picture was a photograph under which Will Hanlon had written, "1933, Repeal in Derry." Although none of the boys knew much about either the Volstead Act or its repeal, the picture made the salient facts clear. The photo was of Wally's Spa down in Hell's Half Acre. The place was almost literally filled to the rafters with men wearing open-collared white shirts, straw boaters, lumbermen's shirts, T-shirts, bankers' suits. All of them were holding glasses and bottles victoriously aloft. There were two big signs in the window. "Welcome back, John Barleycorn," one read. The other said, "Free beer tonight." The clown, dressed like the biggest dandy you ever saw, white shoes, spats, gangster pants, had his foot on the running board of a Rio auto and was drinking champagne from a lady's high-heeled shoe. 1945, Mike said. The Derry News again. The headline, Japan surrenders. It's over. Thank God it's over. A parade was snake dancing its way along Main Street toward Upmile Hill. And there was the clown in the background, wearing his silver suit with the orange buttons, frozen in the matrix of dots that made up the grainy newsprint photo, seeming to suggest, at least to Bill, that nothing was over. No one had surrendered. Nothing was won. Nil was still the rule. Zilch still the custom, seeming to suggest above all that all was still lost. Bill felt cold and dry and scared. Suddenly the dots in the picture disappeared and it began to move. That's what... Mike began.
Lilla, look, Bill said.
The word dropped out of his mouth like a partially melted ice cube.
All of you, look at this.
They crowded around.
Oh, my God,
Beverly whispered, awed.
That's it,
Richie nearly screamed, pounding Bill on the back in his excitement. He looked around at Eddie's white, drawn face and Stan Urus's frozen one.
That's what we saw in George's room. That's exactly what we...
Ben said, listen.
And almost sobbing,
you can hear them. Christ, you can hear them in there.
And in the silence that was only broken by the mild stir of the summer breeze, they all realized they could. The band was playing a martial marching tune, made faint and tinny by distance, or the passage of time, or whatever it was. The cheering of the crowd was like sounds that might come through on a badly tuned radio station. There were popping noises, also faint, like the muffled sound of snapping fingers.
Firecrackers,
Beverly whispered, and rubbed at her eyes with hands that shook.
Those are firecrackers, aren't they?
No one answered. They watched the picture, their eyes eating up their faces. The parade wiggled its way toward them, but just before the marchers reached the extreme foreground, at the point where it seemed they must march right out of the picture and into a world 13 years later, they dropped from sight, as if on some kind of unknowable curve. The World War I soldiers first, their faces strangely old under their pie-plate helmets, with their sign which read, The Derry VFW welcomes home our brave boys. Then the Boy Scouts, the Kiwanians, the Home Nursing Corps, the Derry Christian Marching Band. Then the Derry World War II vets themselves, with the high school band behind them. The crowd moved and shifted. Ticker tape and confetti fluttered down from the second and third floor windows of the business buildings that line the streets. The clown pranced along the sidelines, doing splits and cartwheels, miming a sniper, miming a salute. And Bill noticed for the first time that people were turning from him, but not as if they saw him, exactly. It was more as if they felt a draft or smelled something bad. Only the children really saw him, and they shrank away. Ben stretched his hand out to the picture, as Bill had done in George's room.
No, 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 Bill cried.
I think it's all right, Bill,
Ben said. Look. And he laid his hand on the protective plastic over the picture for a moment, and then took it back.
But if you stripped off that cover...
Beverly screamed. The clown had left off its antics when Ben withdrew his hand. It rushed toward them, its paint-bloody mouth gibbering and laughing. Bill winced back, but held on to the book all the same, thinking it would drop out of sight as the parade had done, and the marching band, and the Boy Scouts, and the Cadillac convertible carrying Miss Derry of 1945. But the clown did not disappear along that curve that seemed to define the edge of that old existence. Instead, it leaped with a scary, nimble grace onto a lamppost that stood in the extreme left foreground of the picture. It shinnied up like a monkey on a stick. And suddenly its face was pressed against the tough plastic sheet Will Hanlon had put over each of the pages in his book. Beverly screamed again, and this time Eddie joined her, although his scream was faint and blue, breathless. The plastic bulged out. Later they would all agree they saw it. Bill saw the bulb of the clown's red nose flatten, the way your nose will flatten when you press it against a window pane.
Kill you all!
The clown was laughing and screaming.
Try to stop me, and I'll kill you all. Drive you crazy, and then kill you all. You can't stop me. I'm the gingerbread man. I'm the teenage werewolf.
And for a moment, it was the teenage werewolf. The moon-silvered face of the lycanthrope peering out at them from over the collar of the silver suit, white teeth bared.
Can't stop me. I'm the leper.
Now the leper's face, haunted and peeling, rotting with sores, stared at them with the eyes of the living dead.
Can't stop me. I'm the money.
The leper's face aged and ran with sterile cracks. Ancient bandages swam halfway out of its skin and solidified there. Ben turned away, his face as white as curds, one hand plastered over his neck and ear.
Can't stop me. I'm the dead boys.
No, Stan Ura screamed. His eyes bulged above bruised-looking crescents of skin.
Shock flesh,
Bill thought randomly. And it was a word he would use in a novel 12 years later, with no idea where it had come from, simply taking it, as writers take the right word at the right time, as a simple gift from that outer space, other space, where the good words come from sometimes. Stan snatched the album from his hands and slammed it shut. He held it closed with both hands, the tendons standing out along the inner surfaces of his wrists and forearms. He looked around at the others with eyes that were nearly insane. No, he said rapidly. No, no, no. And suddenly Bill found he was more concerned with Stan's repeated denials than with the clown, and he understood that this was exactly the sort of reaction the clown had hoped to provoke, because
maybe it's scared of us. Really scared for the first time in its long, long life.
He grabbed Stan and shook him twice, hard, holding onto his shoulders. Stan's teeth clicked together and he dropped the album. Mike picked it up and put it aside in a hurry, not liking to touch it after what he had seen. But it was still his father's, and he understood intuitively that his father would never see in it what he had just seen.
No,
Stan said softly.
Yes,
Bill said.
No,
Stan said again.
Yes, we all... No... all saw it, Stan,
Bill said. He looked at the others.
Yes, Ben said.
Yes,
Richie said.
Yes, Mike said. Oh, my God, yes.
Yes,
Bev said.
Yes,
Eddie managed, gasping it out of his rapidly closing throat. Bill looked at Stan, demanding with his eyes that Stan look back at him.
Don't let it get you, you man,
Bill said.
You saw it, too. I didn't want to,
Stan wailed. Sweat stood out on his brow in an oily sheen.
But you did.
Stan looked at the others one by one. He ran his hands through his short hair and fetched up a great shuddering sigh. His eyes seemed to clear that lowering madness that had so disturbed Bill.
Yes, he said. Yes, okay, yes. That what you want? Yes.
Bill thought, we're still all together. It didn't stop us. We can still kill it. We can still kill it. If we're brave. Bill looked around at the others and saw in each pair of eyes some measure of Stan's hysteria. Not quite as bad, but there.
Yeah,
he said, and smiled at Stan. After a moment, Stan smiled back, and some of that horrible shocked look left his face.
That's what I wanted, you wet end. Beep, beep, Dumbo,
Stan said, and they all laughed. It was hysterical screaming laughter, but better than no laughter at all, Bill reckoned.
Come on,
he said, because someone had to say something. Let's finish the clubhouse. What do you say? He saw the gratitude in their eyes and felt a measure of gladness for them. But their gratitude did little to heal his own horror. In fact, there was something in their gratitude which made him want to hate them. Would he never be able to express his own terror? Lest the fragile welds that made them into one thing should let go? And even to think such a thing wasn't really fair, was it? Because in some measure, at least, he was using them, using his friends, risking their lives, to settle the score for his dead brother. And was even that the bottom? No, because George was dead, and if revenge could be exacted at all, Bill suspected it could only be exacted on behalf of the living. And what did that make him? A selfish little shit waving a tin sword and trying to make himself look like King Arthur? Oh, Christ, he groaned to himself. If this is the stuff adults have to think about, I never want to grow up. His resolve was still strong, but it was a bitter resolve. Bitter. Chapter 15. The Smoke Hole. 1. Richie Tozier pushes his glasses up on his nose. Already the gesture feels perfectly familiar, although he has worn contact lenses for 20 years, and thinks with some amazement that the atmosphere has changed in the room while Mike recalled the incident with the bird out at the ironworks and reminded them about his father's photograph album and the picture that had moved. Richie had felt a mad, exhilarating kind of energy growing in the room. He had done cocaine 9 or 10 times over the last couple of years, at parties mostly. Coke wasn't something you wanted just lying around your house if you were a big-a-time disc jockey. And the feel was something like that, but not exactly. This feeling was purer, more of a mainline high. He thought he recognized the feeling from his childhood when he had felt it every day, and had come to take it merely as a matter of course. He supposed that if he had ever thought about that deep-running aquifer of energy as a kid, he could not recall that he ever had, he would have simply dismissed it as a fact of life, something that would always be there, like the color of his eyes or his disgusting hammer toes. Well, that hadn't turned out to be true. The energy you drew on so extravagantly when you were a kid, the energy you thought would never exhaust itself, that slipped away somewhere between 18 and 24 to be replaced by something much duller, something as bogus as a coke high. Purpose, maybe, or goals, or whatever rah-rah junior chamber of commerce word you wanted to use. It was no big deal. It didn't go all at once with a bang, and maybe Richie thought that's the scary part. How you don't stop being a kid all at once with a big explosive bang, like one of that clown's trick balloons with the Burma Shave slogans on the sides. The kid in you just leaked out like the air out of a tire. And one day you looked in the mirror and there was a grown-up looking back at you. You could go on wearing blue jeans, you could keep going to Springsteen and Seeger concerts, you could dye your hair, but that was a grown-up's face in the mirror just the same. It all happened while you were asleep, maybe, like a visit from the Tooth Fairy. No, he thinks, not the Tooth Fairy, the Age Fairy. He laughs aloud at the stupid extravagance of this image, and when Beverly looks at him questioningly, he waves a hand at her. Nothing, babe, he says. Just thinking, methinks. But now that energy is back. No, not all the way back, not yet anyway, but coming back. And it's not just him, he can feel it filling the room. Mike looks okay to Richie for the first time since they all got together for that hideous lunch out by the mall. When Richie walked into the lobby and saw Mike sitting there with Ben and Eddie, he thought, shocked, there's a man who's going crazy, getting ready to commit suicide, maybe. But that look is gone now. Not just sublimated, gone. Richie has sat right here and watched the last of it slip out of Mike's face while he relived the experience of the bird and the album. He's been energized. And it is the same with all of them. It's in their faces, their voices, their gestures. Eddie pours himself another gin and prune juice. Bill knocks back some bourbon, and Mike cracks another beer. Beverly glances up at the balloons Bill has tethered to the microfilm recorder at the main desk and finishes her third screwdriver in a hurry. They have all been drinking pretty enthusiastically, but none of them are drunk. Richie doesn't know where that energy he feels is coming from, but it's not out of a liquor bottle. Dairy niggers get the bird. Blue. The losers are still losing, but Stanley Uris is finally ahead. Orange. Christ, Richie thinks, opening a fresh beer for himself. It isn't bad enough it can be any damn monster it wants to be, and it isn't bad enough that it can feed off our fears. It also turns out to be Rodney Dangerfield in drag. It's Eddie who breaks the silence. How much do you think it knows about what we're doing now? He asks. It was here, wasn't it? Ben says. I'm not sure that means much, Eddie replies. Bill nods. Those are just images, he says. I'm not sure that means it can see us or know what we're up to. You can see a news commentator on TV, but he can't see you. Those balloons aren't just images, Beverly says, and jerks a thumb over her shoulder at them. They're real. That's not true, though, Richie says, and they all look at him. Images are real. Sure they are. They... And suddenly something else clicks into place, something new. It clicks into place with such firm force that he actually puts his hands to his ears. His eyes widen behind his glasses. Oh, my God, he cries suddenly. He gropes for the table, half stands, then falls back into his chair with a boneless thud. He knocks his can of beer over, reaching for it, picks it up, and drinks what's left. He looks at Mike while the others look at him, startled and concerned. The burning, he almost shouts. The burning in my eyes. Mike, the burning in my eyes. Mike is nodding, smiling a little. Richie? Bill asks. What is it? But Richie barely hears him. The force of the memory sweeps through him like a tide, turning him alternately hot and cold, and he suddenly understands why these memories have come back one at a time.
If he had remembered everything at once, the force would have been like a psychological shotgun blast let off an inch from his temple. It would have torn off the whole top of his head.
"We saw it come," he says to Mike. "We saw it come, didn't we? You and me. Or was it just me?"
He grabs Mike's hand, which lies on the table. "Did you see it too, Mikey, or was it just me? Did you see it? The forest fire, the crater?"
"I saw it," Mike says quietly, and squeezes Richie's hand.
Richie closes his eyes for a moment, thinking he has never felt such a warm and powerful wave of relief in his life. Not even when the PSA jet he had taken from L.A. to San Francisco skidded off the runway and just stopped there. Nobody killed, nobody even hurt. Some luggage had fallen out of the overhead bins, and that was all. He had jumped onto the yellow emergency slide and had helped a woman away from the plane. The woman had turned her ankle on a hummock concealed in the high grass. She was laughing and saying, "I can't believe I'm not dead. I can't believe it. I just can't believe it." So Richie, who was half carrying the woman with one arm and waving with the other to the firemen who were making frantic "come on" gestures to the deplaning passengers, said, "Okay, you're dead. You're dead. You feel better now?" And they both laughed crazily. That had been relief laughter. But this relief is greater.
"What are you guys talking about?" Eddie asks, looking from one to the other.
Richie looks at Mike, but Mike shakes his head.
"You go ahead, Richie. I've had my say for the evening."
"The rest of you don't know, or maybe don't remember, because you left," Richie tells them. "Me and Mikey, we were the last two engines in the smoke hole."
"The smoke hole," Bill muses. His eyes are far and blue.
"The burning sensation in my eyes," Richie says, "under my contact lenses. I felt it for the first time right after Mike called me in California. I didn't know what it was then, but I do now. It was smoke. Smoke that was 27 years old.
He looks at Mike.
"Psychological, would you say? Psychosomatic? Something from the subconscious?"
"I would say not," Mike answers quietly. "I would say that what you felt was as real as those balloons, or the head I saw in the icebox, or the corpse of Tony Tracker that Eddie saw. Tell them, Richie."
Richie says, "It was 4 or 5 days after Mike brought his dad's album down to the Barrens, sometime just after the middle of July, I guess. The clubhouse was done, but the smoke hole thing, that was your idea, Haystack. You got it out of one of your books."
Smiling a little, Ben nods.
Richie thinks, "It was overcast that day, no breeze, thunder in the air. Like the day a month or so later when we stood in the stream and made a circle, and Stan cut our hands with that chunk of Coke bottle. The air was just sitting there, waiting for something to happen. And later Bill said that was why it got so bad in there so quick, because there was no draft.
July 17th. Yes, that was it. That had been the day of the smoke hole. July 17th, 1958. Almost a month after summer vacation began and the nucleus of the losers, Bill, Eddie, and Ben, had formed down in the Barrens.
Let me look up the weather forecast for that day almost 27 years ago, Richie thinks. And I'll tell you what it said before I even read it. Richard Tozier, a.k.a. the Great Metalizer. Hot, humid, chance of thundershowers, and watch out for the visions that may come while you're down in the smoke hole.
It had been 2 days after the body of Jimmy Cullum was discovered, the day after Mr. Nell had come down to the Barrens again and sat right on the clubhouse without knowing it was there, because by then they had capped it off, and Ben himself had carefully overseen the application of the tangle track and replacement of the sods. Unless you got right down on your hands and knees and crawled around, you'd have no idea anything was there. Like the dam, Ben's clubhouse had been a roaring success. But this time Mr. Nell didn't know anything about it. He had questioned them carefully, officially, taking down their answers in his black notebook, but there had been little they could tell him, at least about Jimmy Cullum, and Mr. Nell had gone away again after reminding them once more that they were not to play in the Barrens alone, ever. Richie guessed that Mr. Nell would have told them simply to get out if anyone in the Derry Police Department had really believed that the Cullum boy, or any of the others, had actually been killed in the Barrens. But they knew better. Because of the sewer and storm drain system, that was simply where the remains tended to finish up. Mr. Nell had come on the 16th, yes, a hot and humid day also, but sunny. The 17th had been overcast.
"Are you going to talk to us or not, Richie?"
Bev asks. She is smiling a little, her lips full and a pale rose red, her eyes alight. I'm just thinking about where to start, Richie says. He takes his glasses off, wipes them on his shirt, and suddenly he knows where. With the ground opening up at his and Bill's feet. Of course, he knew about the clubhouse, so did Bill and the rest of them. But it still freaked him out, seeing the ground suddenly open on a slit of darkness like that. He remembers Bill riding him double on the back of Silver to the usual place on Kansas Street, and then stowing his bike under the little bridge. He remembers the two of them walking along the path toward the clearing, sometimes having to turn sideways because the brush was so thick. It was midsummer now, and the barrens were at that year's apogee of lushness. He remembers swatting at the mosquitoes that hummed maddeningly close to their ears. He even remembers Bill saying, "Oh, how clearly it all comes back. Not as if it happened yesterday, but as if it is happening now."
Hold it, assistant.
Two. Eckend, Rarichi. There's a damn gaga hoodwin on the back of your neck.
Oh, Christ,
Richie said. He hated mosquitoes. Little flying vampires, that's all they were when you got right down to the facts.
Kill it, Big Bill.
Bill swatted the back of Richie's neck.
Ouch!
See? Bill held his hand in front of Richie's face. There was a broken mosquito body in the center of an irregular patch of blood.
My blood,
Richie thought,
which was shed for you and for many.
Yuck, he said.
Don't worry, Bill said. Little fucker will never dance the tango again.
They walked on, flapping at mosquitoes, waving at the clouds of no-see-ums attracted by something in the smell of their sweat, something which would years later be identified as pheromones, whatever they were.
Bill, when are you going to tell the rest of them about the silver bullets?
Richie asked as they approached the clearing. In this case, the rest of them meant Bev, Eddie, Mike, and Stan, although Richie guessed Stan already had a good idea of what they were studying up on down at the public library. Stan was sharp. Too sharp for his own good, Richie sometimes thought. The day Mike brought his father's album down to the Barrens, Stan had almost flipped out. Richie had, in fact, been nearly convinced that they wouldn't see Stan again and the Losers Club would become a sextet. A word Richie liked a lot, always with the emphasis on the first syllable. But Stan had been back the next day, and Richie had respected him all the more for that.
You going to tell them today?
Not today,
Bill said. You don't think they'll work, do you? Bill shrugged, and Richie, who maybe understood Bill Denbro better than anyone ever would until Audra Phillips, suspected all the things Bill might have said if not for the roadblock of his speech impediment. That kids making silver bullets was boys' book stuff. Comic book stuff. In a word, it was crap. Dangerous crap. They could try it, yeah. Ben Hanscom might even be able to bring it off, yeah. In a movie, it would work, yeah. But... So?
I got an idea. Bill said.
Simpler. But only if... Beverly...
If Beverly what?
Never mind.
And Bill would say no more on the subject. They came into the clearing. If you looked closely, you might have thought that the grass there had a slightly matted look, a slightly used look. You might even have thought that there was something a bit artificial, almost arranged, about the scatter of leaves and pine needles on top of the sods. Bill picked up a ring-ding wrapper... Ben's, almost certainly, and put it absently in his pocket. The boys crossed to the center of the clearing, and a piece of ground about 10 inches long by 3 inches wide swung up with a dirty squall of hinges, revealing a black eyelid. Eyes looked out of that blackness, giving Richie a momentary chill. But they were only Eddie Kasprak's eyes, and it was Eddie, whom he would visit in the hospital a week later, who intoned hollowly,
"Who's that trip-trapping on my bridge?"
Giggles from below, and a flashlight flicker.
"This is the rally, senhor,"
Richie said, squatting down, twirling an invisible mustache, and speaking in his poncho vanilla voice.
"Yeah?"
Beverly asked from below.
"Let's see your badges."
"Batches?" Richie cried delightedly. "We don't need no stinking batches."
"Go to hell, poncho," Eddie replied, and slammed the big eyelid closed.
There were more muffled giggles from below.
"Come out with your hands up," Bill cried in a low, commanding adult voice.
He began to tramp back and forth across the sod-covered cap of the clubhouse. He could see the ground springing up and down with his back-and-forth passage, but just barely. They had built well.
"You haven't got a chance," he bellowed, seeing himself as fearless Joe Friday of the LAPD in his mind's eye. "Come on out of there, punks, or we'll come in shooting."
He jumped up and down once to emphasize his point. Screams and giggles from below.
Bill was smiling, unaware that Richie was looking at him wisely, looking at him not as one child looks at another, but in that brief moment as an adult looks at a child.
He doesn't know that he doesn't always, Richie thought.
Let them in, Ben, before they crash the roof in,
Bev said. A moment later, a trap door flopped open like the hatch on a submarine. Ben looked out. He was flushed. Richie knew at once that Ben had been sitting next to Beverly. Bill and Richie dropped down through the hatch, and Ben closed it again. Then there they all were, sitting snug against board walls with their legs drawn up, their faces dimly revealed in the beam of Ben's flashlight.
Sister, so what's going on?
Bill asked.
Not too much, Ben said.
He was indeed sitting next to Beverly, and his face looked happy as well as flushed.
We were just... Tell him, Ben, Eddie interrupted. Tell him the story. See what they think.
Wouldn't do much for your asthma, Stan told Eddie in his best someone-has-to-be-practical-here tone of voice.
Ricky sat between Mike and Ben, holding his knees in his linked hands. It was delightfully cool down here, delightfully secret. Following the gleam of the flashlight as it moved from face to face, he temporarily forgot what had so astounded him outside only a minute ago.
What are you talking about? Oh, Ben was telling us a story about this Indian ceremony, Bev said. But Stan's right. It wouldn't be very good for your asthma, Eddie.
It might not bother it, Eddie said, sounding, to his credit, Richie thought, only a little uneasy.
Usually it's only when I get upset. Anyway, I'd like to try it.
Try what? Bill asked him.
The smoke hole ceremony, Eddie said.
Well, what's that?
The beam of Ben's flashlight drifted upward, and Richie followed it with his eyes. It tracked aimlessly across the wooden roof of their clubhouse, as Ben explained. It crossed the gouged and splintered panels of the mahogany door the seven of them had carried back here from the dump 3 days ago, the day before the body of Jimmy Cullum was discovered. The thing Richie remembered about Jimmy Cullum, a quiet little boy who also wore spectacles, was that he liked to play Scrabble on rainy days.
Not going to be playing Scrabble anymore, Richie thought, and shivered a little.
In the dimness, no one saw the shiver, but Mike Hanlon, sitting shoulder to shoulder with him, glanced at him curiously.
Well, I got this book out of the library last week, Ben was saying. Ghosts of the Great Plains, it's called. And it's all about the Indian tribes that lived out west 150 years ago. The Paiutes and the Pawnees and the Kiowas and the Otoes and the Comanches. It was really a good book. I'd love to go out there sometime where they lived. Iowa, Nebraska, Colorado, Utah.
Shut up and tell about the smoke hole ceremony, Beverly said, elbowing him.
Sure, he said, right.
And Richie believed his response would have been the same if Beverly had given him the elbow and said, drink the poison now, Ben, okay?
See, almost all those Indians had a special ceremony, and our clubhouse made me think of it. Whenever they had to make a big decision, whether to move on after the buffalo herds, or to find fresh water, or whether or not to fight their enemies, they'd dig a big hole in the ground and cover it up with branches, except for a little vent in the top.
The smoke hole, Bill said.
Your quick mind never ceases to amaze me, Big Bill, Richie said gravely. You ought to go on 21. I'll bet you could even beat old Charlie Van Doren.
Bill made as if to hit him, and Richie recoiled, bumping his head a pretty good one on a piece of shoring.
Ouch! You deserved it, Bill said. I kill you, rotten gringo sumbeesh, Richie said. We don't need no stinking...
Will you guys stop it? Beverly asked. This is interesting.
And she favored Ben with such a warm look that Richie believed steam would start curling out of Haystack's ears in a couple of minutes.
Okay, Ben, Bill said. Go on.
Sure,
Ben said. The word came out in a croak. He had to clear his throat and start again.
When the smoke hole was finished, they'd start a fire down there. They'd use green wood so it would be a really smoky fire. Then all the braves would go down there and sit around the fire. The place would fill up with smoke. The book said this was a religious ceremony, but it was also kind of a contest, you know? After half a day or so, most of the braves would bug out because they couldn't stand the smoke anymore, and only two or three would be left, and they were supposed to have visions.